It is an honor, and I'm sure you will all agree it will be an interesting talk. Distinguished Alumni Award recipient is Dr. Christia Ludlow, who is currently a professor at James Madison University, and I learned today in charge of the doctoral program. I won't give you too much of her background because Linda will cover it during the awards ceremony, but Christy has been doing many things over many years. It is actually amazing to look over her vita and see some of the things that she has been involved in. She, as you may know from looking at the program, she graduated, got her BA and MA from McGill, and today, just by coincidence, managed to attend her high school reunion, which is just phenomenal. She got her degree, PhD, from New York University in psycholinguistics and speech pathology. She is also director of the Laboratory of Neural Bases of Communication and Swallowing at James Madison University in Virginia. She has a storied history. It actually is just phenomenal. And in addition to being at NIH as part of both the extramural and intramural program, she's also received honors of the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, the American Laryngological Association, and the American Academy of Otolaryngology. In the last 5 years, she has conducted clinical trials in collaboration with industry, was responsible for investigational device exemption trials under the Food and Drug Administration, and is both a principal investigator and sponsor, and has filed patents for neurorehabilitation. The thing that is most amazing to me, so her areas of research interests are vast, looking at the role of enhancing sensory feedback and neural control for voice, speech, and swallowing, the use of sensory enhancement during motor training for recovery from dysphagia, as well as diagnosis and assessment of spasmodic dysphonia. But the thing that strikes me as the most amazing is looking over her over 140 research publications and the depth and breadth at which she has been engaged in research, from setting research priorities in spasmodic dysphonia, doing behavioral, physiological, neurophysiological studies, in both focused predominantly in the larynx, but also on brain mechanisms associated with stuttering, as well as spasmodic dysphonia, has engaged in animal work in both rat and cat, and some students. No, that was a joke. And looking at also receptor properties, dopamine receptor properties, D1 and D2, drug treatment trials, and also in genetic studies of speech and language disorders, as well as she was one of the first, I believe, to look at the effects of Botox as a treatment for spasmodic dysphonia. So it is with great pleasure that I introduce Christy, who will talk today on her title of her talk is Developing Patient-Centered Models for Neurorehabilitation of Voice and Swallowing Disorders. Christy.
I want to say what an honor this is to be here. It's a real thrill to be to my alma mater, and it's been decades since I've been back here, so this is really sweet to me, and I've been able to visit friends and family and even go to my old high school, so it's been really fun today. I'm going to give a very clinical talk today. Sometimes I do neural mechanisms and things like that, but this is more taking some neurophysiology and trying to use it for developing new clinical delivery systems. And so that's going to be the focus. First of all, I have to start off with disclosures. I hold patents on some of the devices that I'll be discussing, and I've received not only NIH funds, but also two companies have supported some of the work that I'll be talking about. And if I live long enough, I might benefit financially from some of these devices. Okay, so the outline of my talk today is going to be starting with what are the evidence that dysphagia therapy for swallowing disorders is helpful for patients with swallowing problems. This is going to be starting off with a review that I was last asked to do last summer on looking at the effects of swallowing therapy versus non-swallowing therapy, and this became a larger task than I originally thought I had agreed to. This where we looked at the last 2 years of research in dysphagia therapy. And the person who braved this with me was Teresa Drulia, one of the PhD students. And we started off by searching everything on dysphagia therapy, which turned out to be pretty large, and narrowed it down to 30 studies that were random controlled trials or controlled clinical trials. We eliminated three of those and ended up with 27 studies. And surprisingly, although dysphagia therapy is a fairly new area, there were quite a few good, well-designed random controlled trials. One was on direct swallowing therapy. Others, about 10, were on indirect therapy. That is where somebody was doing something with a drug or stimulation in some way to help the patients and to see if that would benefit their swallowing. But most popular, and this is a direction that the field seems to go in, is taking some other approaches and combining those with swallowing therapy. So brain stimulation, other things, is synchronous with the dysphagia therapy. And so I'm going to discuss what the evidence of those are. What we did was we examined each one of these studies and computed the effect size using Cohen's D to determine what the relative benefits of each one of these therapies was. And we started off, of course, some, as you know, 0.2 is no effect. 0.2 to 0.5 is really a very small effect. You're only changing it by half a standard deviation. And then you get up to moderate effects and something that's closer to one where you're moving the function to equal the standard deviation. So overall, when you look at dysphagia therapy alone, the effect sizes are very small, 0.3 to 0.4, which is a little discouraging. Other single modalities where you try and change the drug manipulation or do stimulation and not do therapy had a somewhat better range of effect sizes. And the only one that was the study of just dysphagia therapy was done by McCullough using the Mendelsohn training and had this very low effect size. Some of the ones that did other kinds of therapy to see if it would help swallowing were jaw opening exercises or transcranial magnetic stimulation, and those had a higher effect size of 0.7. Sensory, such as ice massage, also had relatively small effect size, and levodopa for Parkinson's disease had a small effect size. Deep brain stimulation, which is, of course, being used now for Parkinson's disease a lot, had a fairly good benefit on swallowing in three studies, and these seem to range into the 0.7 range. Now, if we look at the combination of using some other manipulation, such as brain stimulation, and swallowing therapy together, so you're doing two modalities to combine, the effect sizes range all over the place. You go from 0.3 to 1.2. Spontaneous recovery, however, when you look at what just happens to a patient without any treatment in the first couple of months post-CVA, has a fairly large effect. So this can overwhelm any therapeutic effect because it's so huge. So some of these studies, one using exercise with swallowing therapy, had a very small effect size. Another one also using exercise with swallowing therapy had a much larger effect size. Video feedback, so that the patient watched the nasoendoscopy recording while they were swallowing, had a fairly good effect size. So this combined with swallowing therapy compared to sham and swallowing therapy was a pretty good effect. Transcranial direct current, TDCS, is probably the most encouraging of these studies. This is where you're using a very low current passed over the cortex, and this combined with therapy had a pretty good effect. However, each one of these studies was well controlled and looked at spontaneous recovery, and you can see there that the spontaneous recovery was massive compared to the therapeutic effect. And then something that's been a big issue in the swallowing field has been electrical stimulation on the muscles in the throat, and known as neuromuscular electrical stimulation. And you can see that there are effect sizes of 0.5 and 0.7. Using it with therapy, sometimes using it with resistance so that somebody's working against the stimulation. And these are pretty moderate effect sizes. Okay, so to summarize then, swallowing therapy alone is small. It's 0.4 to 0.5. Using brain stimulation without swallowing therapy, either deep brain stimulation, levodopa, or TMS, you get moderate effect sizes. When you add some of these other therapies to swallowing therapy is when you get larger effects, but we have to remember that spontaneous recovery is a huge effect. So given where we are, one of the things that's to be observed is all of these studies used a very small dosage of therapy. They usually use 2 weeks or 10 sessions of swallowing therapy. Patients were swallowing during the therapy, and usually that allows them to get one swallow per minute, so they get 600 swallows in their therapy. Some of the outpatient was a lower intensity, that is only 1 hour a week for 6 weeks, giving you 360 swallows. So the question is, can we change the regimen and improve swallowing therapy in some way? Methods of optimizing therapy might be to extend the dosage, to increase the intensity, do it more every day, or to do it longer, or combining some of these other modalities. As I showed you, TDCS, the transcranial electrical stimulation, was very beneficial when added to swallowing therapy. So might these kinds of approaches help us get a better effect? One of the things that has been plaguing speech pathology since I was trained is carryover and how much the behavior that you can do with a patient in the clinic and what happens to them when they go outside the clinic is hugely different. Behavior seems to be very context sensitive. Therapy usually takes place in the clinic or at the bedside, in inpatient rehabilitation or the outpatient office, and the problem is transferring the new behavior that you can shape in one location and get it into the patient's natural environment. And the benefit really has to be when the patient is eating or speaking in their own home environment. I'm going to show you a very small pilot study we did to address this issue. We wanted to look at changes in speech intelligibility in Parkinson's disease and their amplitude of speech intensity. And what we did was the standard clinical evaluation where we measured them in the clinic, and they used the speech intelligibility test, which is a standard that was developed by Yorkson. We also used the LENA recorder. I borrowed this from a fellow down the hall who does infant speech, and this is a recorder that a lot of people who do infant speech use. It's a digital encrypted system so that you can record for 16 hours continuously in the natural environment. And we also figured out how to calibrate this so we could measure sound pressure level both in the clinic and from the LENA. And these are just 4 patients. This is a pilot study, the very beginning area. None of them had DBS. Now, this is the Lena. It's a really nifty little device. You can put it in a pocket or put it on your lapel and wear it around. And we had all sorts of combinations for patients wearing it. But the question is, how much is the effect size between what a patient is doing in the clinic and what they do at home? And so this was measuring the percent intelligibility in their speech in the clinic. And the percent intelligibility when we took sentences that were the same length or utterances that were the same length as what they were did in the speech intelligibility test in the clinic. And we measured the change and the standard deviation and got an effect size for each one of these people. These varied a fair amount, but we get an average effect size of one. So this problem of carryover is really something that's pretty significant. Interestingly, even our normal control differed on how they spoke when they were sitting in a room with a microphone in front of them, which we all do. You put a microphone in front of us and we straighten up our act. We looked at sound pressure level as well, and because this has been a big issue in the hypophonia and Parkinson's disease, and we found that there was a difference also in the mean sound pressure level in these sentences between the clinic and home, and this had an average effect size of 1.3. Interesting, no change in our control, and we're still doing more of this work, but this is just an initial foray to see how much difference there is in behavior in a clinic which is well structured and when you're out in your normal environment. Now, people are developing some devices to carry over from the clinic into the patient environment. One I've been working with was developed by Jessica Huber at Purdue University, which is the Speech Vive device, which is a little ear, looks like a hearing aid. You put it on the side of your one ear, and it plays cocktail noise in one side, and you get the Lombard effect, and so it increases the sound pressure level, the amplitude of speech in the local environment in the patient. So now what the question is, if we're going to try and intervene and improve our therapy effects, what is the healthcare delivery system that we're dealing with? Now, some of what I will say will be just for the US, but many of these are world trends that are problems in many countries. First of all, we have the baby boomers coming up, and you can see that the percent of people in the older age levels where we have neurological diseases is increasing. Right now we're at this level and it's increasing over time. So this is a problem that all countries have to deal with. I think Japan is probably most affected, but each country is being affected by this. Now there's also a ratio of who's going to do therapy and help out these older folks, and the ratio of support between number of people who can help your elderly population or your sick older population is reducing. We used to have 13 other people in the population who could support our older folks, and now we're down to around 3.5, of people that are able to support us. So we have a massive problem in increasing older folks and reduced support for them. Also, we have a change in patient preference. Our patients are becoming much more active and much more aggressive about what they want rather than what we want them to do. When given, this was a survey that was done on older adults, when given a choice of where they wanted to have their health care, most of them wanted to be at home with their family. Otherwise, they wanted to have paid caregivers come into their home. Didn't particularly want to go to their family's home, and they certainly didn't want to be a resident in assisted living as much and or in a nursing home. Only 10% would select a nursing home. This is a worldwide trend. In fact, this increasing population is a problem in even the underdeveloped countries. Yeah, with better health and better nutrition, we're having an older population to a greater degree everywhere. And so we have people who want to age in place. They want to stay in their home. They want health care to come into them rather than the other way around. They don't want to go to specialized care facilities, which of course are costly, and they view negatively. And a large proportion of older folks are now living alone on their own, and they don't have a large family network around to help them. So when we look at healthcare and where we're going to intervene with this increasing population, fewer people to support them, we need to look at where the points of intervention are. Well, if you look at patients post-CVA, there are some decision points that happen. First of all, the patient comes in with an acute stroke to the hospital. Then the question is, where do you discharge them to? The patient wants to go home. Other people may send them to skilled nursing facilities or to rehabilitation facilities. Then after they've been there for a while, do they get sent home, the patient's preference, or do they get sent to a skilled nursing facility? After being there, they then have the decision-making point of going home or going to long-term care. Now, what I'd like to point out, as you move down this chart, you have less and less access to therapy and to intervention and help. And so most of our patients want to end up at home, but that's not where they can get the therapy. Some of them will go to outpatient rehabilitation therapy, but that takes somebody to drive you there, or you have to drive there, you have to park, and that's a problem. And many patients don't do this for very long. So the patient's objective is to go home. And transportation for them to come back into the healthcare facilities is less and less able. Fewer and fewer people are able to help them with the transportation. And therefore, they want the therapy to come to them at home. And devices are one opportunity that we have for doing that, to allow the patient to do therapy in their own environment. Now, there are examples from the voice field where people are doing that. We have apps on our smartphones that we can use to provide patients with the target in voice and for them to try and match that target. And people are doing a lot of that in voice therapy. Edie Hafner is an example of a person who's working in that. We give patients, you can buy a sound level meter for $50 at Radio Shack and take it home and practice on your loudness level. And so you can learn how to increase your loudness if you're a patient with Parkinson's disease. With dysarthria, there are metronome apps that you can download easily for free and use that to pace your speech and change your speech pacing. Rita Patel has been working on video virtual environments, so you can provide these Google glasses and a patient can be in a group setting when they're actually sitting alone in a room, so they're in a virtual environment communicating with other folks. And then I mentioned the Speech Vive device that Jessica has developed. So we have the possibility of devices. Now, in swallowing therapy, we're not doing as well as the voice area. We do have VitalStim, which is a device, but that can only be used in the clinic by the therapist. That was one of the restrictions in the approval of the device. And so it can only be used if the patient can get into the therapeutic setting. And usually it's used for about 10 sessions. Now, submental electrical stimulation, which I could talk about for a while, but I'm not going to, but it can be used by the patient at home. It has been found to have an effect size that's, just a bit above small. And Langmore just finished a study and showed no benefit of using submental electrical stimulation. Joanne Robbins is using tongue strengthening, which is the most device, but it's not used for actually swallowing. So how might we make more effective therapy in dysphagia? And that's really where I'm going today. First of all, we know that patients for neurorehabilitation, and this is happening in the limb literature and all sorts of areas, is you have to use it to prevent reduction or continued loss. You have to do extensive practice. Repetition is very important, intensity of that practice, and the task has to be salient. So pressing your tongue against the palate of your mouth might not help you with swallowing. As Jerry Logeman says, swallowing is the best therapy for swallowing. So let's look at the swallowing system. We have the central pattern generator in the brainstem, which is available to the infant. In fact, they're swallowing in utero, and so that's a marionette system that's there all the time. Now, what we do as humans is we develop cortical control. This is learned and associated with verbal labels. I tell anybody out in the street to swallow and they'll swallow. So we have developed good cortical control, and in fact this system does have input to the brainstem system and can activate the central pattern generator in the ventral swallowing group. Now, another thing that we know that's important for swallowing is peripheral sensory input or afferent input. I'm going to talk about that for a minute. So here's a schematic, very gross, on our system. We have the volitional control for swallowing in the cortex and in the M1. Taste and other things can modulate it. We have the central pattern generator in the medulla, and we have sensory inputs to that. In fact, I'm going to show you some studies where the sensory input to the brainstem is transferred up to the cortex, and you can see activation in the cortical regions. And then we have the central pattern generator that produces the pharyngeal motor patterning for swallow. So one thing, as I showed you already, people have started using TMS and TDCS to try and manipulate that cortical activation. And the idea is that if you activate the cortex, you reduce the threshold so somebody can control their swallowing mechanism more easily. Here were two of the studies that we had in our review that did that. They used direct current stimulation that excites the cortical neurons, lowers the threshold for cortical activation, and enhances the patient's ability to produce volitional swallowing. And both of these had some pretty good effect sizes. However, the problem is, if you've ever seen TDCS, you have two great big pads that are soaked in saline, and you walk around with them connected to an electrical source, and not exactly user-friendly for walking out to a restaurant and eating. This is not going to be a transportable system, so you can use it in the clinic, and it is invasive because it does do electrical stimulation over the cortex. Can't be done without supervision. So this is not something that we could transfer to the patient in their home setting. So one of the approaches we've been looking at is whether sensory input, which will activate the central pattern generator in the brainstem and also send stimulation up to the cortex, might this be another way of activating the cortical system? So there are two types of sensory input that are really important in swallowing. One is the sensory input from the larynx through the superior laryngeal nerve that goes up to the region of the medulla. There's also the glossopharyngeal nerve, which is in the fossial pillars in the back of the tongue, in the tongue and pharyngeal area. And if you stimulate that, both of these go to the nucleus tractus solitarius, which interestingly enough goes to the pons and then sends bilateral, this is just unilateral stimulation, sends bilateral signals to the thalamus and then to both cortices. So our cranial system for the sensory input has a unilateral input that can go to both sides of the brain. Now, there's some nice cat studies showing that if you use this sensory input, either the glossopharyngeal or the laryngeal nerve, and stimulate them, you can produce reflex swallowing or fictive swallowing. So here's some data from this study. Here is where they were doing the glossopharyngeal nerve, and they're stimulating it repetitively over time. And this is the animal swallowing. And these were animals under anesthesia, so we don't think that this is due to any other control for swallowing, but rather stimulating the central pattern generator in the brainstem. Similarly, if they stimulate the superior laryngeal nerve, the sensory nerve from the larynx, at a regular rate, you can also induce these reflective, fictive swallowing. And if you combine the two together, you really get the animal going swallowing away like mad. Now, you know, eliciting a swallow using sensory stimulation is a good idea, but how much do you need that sensory feedback while you're swallowing? And there we have both animal studies and human studies to tell us something. This was a study recording from the superior laryngeal nerve in animals while they were doing different swallowing gestures. And so here is when the larynx is actually closing, the two vocal folds are compressing, and this is recording from the superior laryngeal nerve showing very active afferents coming back to the brainstem. Here is during the animal when the elevation of the larynx occurs, the hyolaryngeal elevation part occurs, and you can see a burst during that elevation in the superior laryngeal nerve. And interestingly, even if you put lidocaine on the mucosa, you still get this burst. So it's to do with a lot of proprioceptive feedback as well. So internal superior laryngeal nerve responses during swallowing are there. They record stimulation of the mucosa during vocal fold closure. They record compression in the thyroid cartilage, discharges when you put water in the pharynx, and it also discharges as the larynx goes up in swallowing. Now, this is probably one of those critical studies that you just absolutely love. This was done by Jaffari in 2003. And there they did bilateral superior laryngeal nerve blocks with bupivacaine, which lasts a pretty long time in healthy young adults. These were all cheery medical students who, volunteered. And they found that all of these people complained that after this bilateral sensory block of the larynx, that's all that was affected, that they had a very hard time initiating a swallow. They also found that it disrupted the patterning of swallowing, so sensory feedback to the system is extremely important. They induced, these were all normal folks, no penetration or aspiration, they induced penetration in 43% of the swallows, and they produced aspiration in 22%. So sensory feedback to the system in the central pattern generator is essential to keeping that normal mechanism functioning. So myself and others have been looking at different types of stimulation, how they might initiate swallowing, such as the glossopharyngeal stimulation, and superior laryngeal nerve stimulation, whether that will initiate swallowing and help with feedback during swallowing. Ruth Martin, who's over at Western, has been doing work with a device that uses air puffs and puts the air puff onto the fascial pillars. And this is a device that's fit on the patient's teeth. I think she's now moved it to the top dentures rather than the bottom dentures. And so they provide air puffs to the fascial pillars. And she found that compared to baseline, they increase the rate of swallowing with unilateral stimulation and then also greater with bilateral stimulation. So similar to the animal studies, you can do stimulation in the glossopharyngeal nerve and elicit swallowing in humans. Both Ruth's group and our group looked at whether this sensory input goes to the cortex because, as I said, you want to be able to activate the brainstem system, but it would be nice if we could lower the threshold in the cortical system. And so this is a study that we did on 14 healthy volunteers, and we only provided unilateral air puff stimulation to the fascial pillars on just the right side. And we compared the pattern of activation with the air puff to healthy volunteers' spontaneous swallowing. And we found a very similar fMRI bold response. Here's the air puff. You can see you get bilateral activation, which is very enheartening. You can get posterior central, which is the more of the sensory areas. You get bilateral basal ganglia to some degree. This is very similar to what happened in spontaneous swallows. You get same regions, a little bit greater during spontaneous swallowing and a little bit more in the basal ganglia, but very similar patterns. So you're activating that central control system with sensory stimulus to one side. So here the sensory stimulation can induce the brainstem swallowing, as Ruth showed, and you can increase the activation to the cortical area. Now the problem with the intraoral stimulation is it's hard to wear a palate with air puffs in your fascial pillars and go and eat. The bolus gets mixed up in there. It also messes up your air puff going to your fascial pillars, and wearing an intraoral appliance while you're trying to eat can be pretty cumbersome. So we wanted to consider a different kind of stimulus. And so we went to the superior laryngeal nerve mechanism, which is the, and there have been some very nice studies many years ago showing that vibration activates the superior laryngeal nerve. That vibration, if you vibrate the thyroid cartilage, it will penetrate to other tissues. There is no adaptation to vibration because vibration is always alternating in two different directions. And it can stimulate mechanoreceptors that excite the brainstem, and we thought maybe this would also increase swallowing. So here's the concept here. You put a vibrator on the front of the throat over the thyroid cartilage. You vibrate it, and then you can vibrate all of the mucosa and muscles that are attached to that cartilage. And so this can be non-invasive. It doesn't interfere with eating or doing anything else. And so we started doing this kind of stimulation and looked at different frequencies of stimulation and whether they would increase the rate of swallowing. So this is the percent increase in swallowing for several different frequencies, 30 hertz, 70 hertz, 110, 150. And this is a combination of different frequencies. And we found when we used a combination of frequencies, we could really increase the swallowing rate in healthy volunteers. And everybody increased by 100%. Some went as high as 300%. So you can get a fairly increased drive, the swallowing system, using this vibrator quite nicely. And the statistical analysis showed that we were very, if we used this combination of different frequencies, we were much more effective than using one particular frequency alone. And the only other frequency that was the same as the hybrid was 70. So then the question was, if we use vibration on the throat, is this going to go to the cortex? So here we used what's known as the poor man's fMRI. But it's useful because you can take all sorts of devices and use it with people, both for therapy and other things. So this is functional near-infrared spectroscopy. You have an emitter that emits laser wavelengths, and it goes through the skull, through the cortex, and then you have a detector that picks up the laser light after it's been through the cortex. And they found that the a change of the wavelengths will be altered according to the amount of oxygenation in the hemoglobin. So you're looking at blood flow and oxygenation of blood flow. So this is like the hemodynamic response that you see in fMRI, except you can do this continuously. You can record this and then pull out certain events and average them. So it's very clinically useful. And here what we did was we used the subject's MRI, their anatomical MRI, used BrainSight to place the optodes so that we could be sure to be over the same regions in each person using MNI coordinates. And we wanted to record from the M1 premotor area and the sensory area. And so that's, we did that on both sides. And because we were particularly interested, are we only getting stimulation in the sensory area, or are we getting stimulation or activation in the motor area? And we found that those who increased their swallowing to the greatest degree had an increase in the hemodynamic response to the greatest degree. And interestingly, this was on the right sensory area, and there's been quite a debate about right-left in swallowing. So this was an interesting effect. So activation of the cortex is clearly related to the amount of increase of swallowing frequency. Okay, so here we have heightened sensory input to activate the brainstem and the cortex. We can use it while the patient is attempting to swallow and when we put things in their mouth. And the idea is that the stimulation reduces the neuronal threshold for them to volitionally activate their swallowing system. So here's our happy camper. He has a vibrator on his neck. He has a controller to turn the vibration on. And what we did was train these people to turn the vibration on 350 milliseconds before they started to swallow. So this is the accelerometer showing when they started to swallow. And we had them turn on the stimulator just before that. And most people within 20 trials can learn to do this pretty well. Even these were brainstem stroke patients, and they learned to do this within 20 trials. So that's pretty easy. And we had a device that we built, and this was work at NIH, where we had a manual device where the same device was used either in the manual or automatic mode. They could do 60 trials or more if they wanted to at home. All of the work was done at home. None of it was done in the clinic. And the patient took the device home, turned it on, and while they practiced swallowing at home. Now, we also had automatic mode because we were working with brainstem strokes, and these people often had difficulty controlling saliva and were spitting in a cup all day long. Pretty gross. You can't drive a car or go shopping or do anything like that when you're spitting in a cup. So we wanted to help them on that, and we had the automatic mode. It was programmed according to how much salivation they had, and so it was either going off every 3 to 5 minutes once for about 10 seconds, giving them a chance to try and control their saliva every time it went on. And they wore the device all day long, every day of the week. So we had a daily training in their living environment. The idea is the patient wears the device whenever they're awake. If you calculate how many swallows you get every day when you do this with the automatic mode and the manual mode, we are getting at least 300 swallows every day. If you remember some of the ratios that people were getting with therapy, we're getting more in one day than people are getting over many weeks. Our training, a minimum that we asked people to do was 60 swallows a day. We used a very small amount of liquid equivalent to saliva. They gave it to themselves in a syringe, held it in their mouth, turned on the device, and swallowed. And then they came back every 3 months to see how they were doing. They were reevaluated, and if they'd improved, they were allowed to increase the amount and variety of their intake. And so that was a small celebration in the video fluoroscopy suite. And so the idea is that if you can increase the therapy dosage and augment volitional retraining with sensory stimulation, this is a patient-centered type of therapy and allows the patient to be able to focus on using their therapy at home. So I'm going to show you some preliminary studies with 4 cases. These were all brainstem strokes. They were at least the average duration since the stroke was 4 years. All were on a PEG tube and spitting in a cup, and all had failed traditional therapy as well as other approaches to try and help their swallowing. These were patients who were very brave. They agreed to practice at home. Some did, some didn't. We could inquire the device to see how much they had actually practiced, and so verbal report didn't always agree. We trained them on the device initially for 2 weeks. The speech-language pathologist trained them, but all the work was done at home, and none of them developed an aspiration pneumonia over a year, so I don't think it was of risk to them. So these are the swallowing quality of life. And you can see our 4 patients. Some got better, some did not. Here was our star. She was up eating normally. Some got improved. This person, the red line, did not use the device at all, so that's almost a control. And the black line, they came and went. This is how much they were able to increase their intake. The person who didn't use it didn't increase their intake at all. Others, this person was eating everything normally. These other two improved to some degree. So it's a encouraging but certainly not a demonstration. But of course I want to show you our best example, and this is the person who did so well. And this is her pre-training on the modified barium swallow. We're giving her a very liquid volume to swallow. And you can see that she can't get anything down the UES, and she has a great deal of difficulty. She's aspirating everything that you give her. Now, if we go to the next, this is 6 months afterwards. She was training on the device. She's using the device at this point. You can see she already has some residue. She's certainly not normal. but she's improved her swallowing. She can now get food and liquid through the upper esophageal sphincter. And there is some residual there, which is clearly risky, but she was doing pretty well. And this is a year later. She gave us back the device. She got her peg out. She wasn't interested in doing this anymore, but she agreed to come back and do this. We have this on so that we don't know when we're doing the ratings whether she's using a device or not. She wasn't using any stimulation at this point. And she's improved. She's not normal, but she's improved significantly in her ability to intake things, and she's eating everything amazingly. Okay, so this is the current system that we're using. The patient wears it. They have their automatic or manual controller. Here's an example of a caregiver. We find everybody does better if they have a team member at home. And so the family has to get involved in this and buy into it. The patient who didn't use it, the family was not enthusiastic about that. And the phase one case series we're doing now to gather patient feedback during use of a newer device. We're doing random controlled trials to determine whether therapy with or without the device makes a difference, because it may be just the practice that people swallowing all day long makes them better. And we're looking at oral intake and recovery of safe swallowing as our outcome variables. So back to my original problem. Our problems were that the treatment effect sizes are small, the behavior is context sensitive, and the population changes mean that we're going to have a huge increase in demand. Solutions: applying principles to make the patient use therapy more intensively and for a longer duration. Using sensory stimulation to modify their cortical and brainstem control, and patients censored so they can retrain themselves at home. So I want to acknowledge all the people who have taken part in some of this work and still ongoing. My JMU students, people who worked with me at NIH, and we've had support from both the federal government as well as companies. Thank you for listening. Do we have time for questions or discussion? No questions? Okay.
Well, I'm curious about a number of things. In terms of the stimulation that you're using now for the trials, are you using the hybrid?
Yes, definitely the hybrid. And it's interesting, we didn't know what frequency to use because there were some studies many, many years ago by Doty showing that 30 hertz was great in rabbits and 60 hertz was great in dogs, so that's why we use such a big range. It turns out we're a little bit of rabbit and dog all mixed in. The hybrid really combines different motors together at the same time, and that really seems to provide a greater stimulus. So that was a normal, we had different, those were healthy volunteers who did that study, and they came in on different days in different orders and had either sham stimulation or different frequencies. So it was cross-controlled. We got bilateral. The sensory seems, we're doing a lot of NIRS studies in swallowing right now, and the sensory activity seems to be greater on the right side, but the motor, you're bilateral on both sides for both sensory and motor, but the motor seems to be more on the left side. So but the sensory effects seem to be greater on the right side. So that was a bit of a surprise. Right.
It seems like the vibrator, the stimulator, is probably something that you got from, I don't know where.
Well, we were using, initially we used a large cylindrical motor. We've gone through several iterations. We've done some infant work as well with a little pancake motor. We get the same effects in infants. We've gone through several. Now we have two different motors on either side, so we get two frequencies going into the thyroid cartilage at the same time.
But
Yes, the whole idea is that this is a discardable device that you give to the patient to take home and use on their own, and so that you don't have any, not a major cost. Like a crutch.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Any other question?
Gosh.
Well.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening.
Well, thank you for talking.